Hi, and welcome to another episode of KC Caffeine. My name is Jason, and today we have a very, very special guest, someone I've been trying to get on the podcast for a while, and someone who I think is really knowledgeable on the topics that we're going to talk about today. Quick thing we're going to do, we're doing a video for him. I'll let him introduce himself and what we're doing for him, and then we'll go right into what you'd like to do.
Yeah, well, one, I would just thank you for letting me be here on your show. But my name is Austin Strassel. We've known each other for a long time.
Almost over 10 years.
Over 10 years at this point, yeah. A little bit about me. I am a master's student at the University of Kansas for urban planning. I do a lot of research and work around housing issues. And what I'm doing with you today is we're doing a recording on the topic of home and what it means for LGBTQ folks and their journey to find home in a world where that may be more difficult to do than for our heterosexual counterparts.
Awesome.
So this is an oral history project. And so the less talking that I do, the better.
Okay. Well, we can get started whenever you're ready.
Yes, absolutely.
And I wanted you guys to hear this as well. I thought it would be an interesting thing, and check out Austin's wherever you can. We'll get into more how to find him and all that stuff later, but let's get started.
Yes, so this will be pretty easy. I'm going to just ask some very broad questions. I always like to ask people to tell me their favorite memory first, just to kind of get the stories flowing in our brains.
Okay, I actually was thinking about that, and I think I have to say my favorite story would be when my partner surprised me with my parents.
Wow, okay.
It was a couple years back. My parents had never been here. I think I'd been here like 7 years. And, you know, any time that we had tried to make a trip happen for them to come here, it would just always fall through. And it was my birthday. And I just, there was this big elaborate plan to get me to the hotel where my parents were at. And so, like, they were here, they got to spend the weekend, had a party, you know, my friends were all coming in. And then I found out that, like, everyone knew this was happening, and no one said a word to me about it. It was, like, it's, a part of it is, I've always wanted, you know, I'm very close with my family, I'm very close with my parents. I recognize that's not a thing. I think not a lot of LGBT people have. So I'm blessed in that regard, and you know, so to have them here and kind of see what my life was like here really meant a lot. I think that's one of my favorite memories.
Awesome. Well, thank you for sharing that. Yeah. That sounds like it was a really exciting and amazing time.
It was. It was fun.
So I'm exploring the topic of home. And so we know that housing and home aren't necessarily the same thing.
Right.
That the shelter that we inhabit may not necessarily be our home. And so I want to hear from you your journey to finding home and what that looked like for you.
Well, I grew up in a small town in Virginia, military. We were lucky that we didn't move around while I was growing up. So I've always kind of had a stable kind of home, even if the people around me weren't moving or were moving a lot. I tended to be able to kind of stay there. And like I said, I have my parents were very open and accepting. Not so much when I was a kid, but definitely as I got older. And then from there, I moved and we lived in Florida. And then that's when kind of I jumped around quite a bit. I had friends. I was always the person who was like staying on someone's couch, or one time I slept in someone's closet because that's just what you do.
Yeah.
You know, and then was there for 9 years, and then I moved here. And interestingly enough, when I moved here, like, it immediately felt like home.
How so?
I felt safe. Like, I felt like there was I felt like I was able to put down roots for the first time. Because being military, you know, even though we didn't move around a lot, that threat of moving was always there. So while you could, you know, while I didn't go anywhere, it was always like, okay, well, you know, don't get too close to people, or don't, you know, form strong bonds, really, because at any point in time, this person could be gone. And then, like I said, when I moved to Florida, I moved around a lot. And so I kind of jumped from friend group to friend group to friend group, and didn't really kind of have a place where I was able to feel like safe and grounded. And then when I moved here, it was just like, okay, like, cool. You know, my partner had roots here. It felt safer to actually put down roots. And that wasn't necessarily an easy journey. It wasn't an easy thing for me to do. But it was, I think I grew up a lot, and anyone who's known me for longer than, you know, 10 years can tell you that, like, I grew up a lot in the time that I've been here. And I think that's a big thing for, you know, LGBT people and, you know, and really people of color, anyone who's kind of lived a transient lifestyle, that once you're able, you grow so much once you're able to put down roots and just be somewhere and feel safe and feel like, okay, this is the place where I can spread my wings. I hope I answered your question.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, that was great. Do you think that it's harder for LGBT folks to put down roots or to find this concept of home?
Yeah, I definitely think so. I think part of it is because we are always... we always have to worry about what the neighbors think. And, you know, if the person who is in close proximity to us has an issue with just our very existence. And so you have to think about, okay, well, you know, do I have to hide this part of myself to the people who are closest to me, you know, in proximity? And, you know, you, especially now, you know, I'm blessed to have neighbors that are amazing. And, but that wasn't always the case. And I remember having issues, you know, with neighbors just for being the gay dude who walked around, you know, wasn't doing anything, wasn't having, you know, wasn't out here having wild parties. It was just my very existence was offensive to them. And I think the door is about to open. Yes, it is. Okay, yeah, sometimes because of, you know, like, just the, your very being and who you are can be offensive to someone. And so you have to kind of hide yourself. And I think that at some point, or when LGBT people finally find that place where they feel safe enough to spread their wings, I think that's can take longer than it can for, you know, heterosexual people.
And what I've gathered is that here in Kansas City, or, you know, in this area, this is where you felt safe, and this is where you felt like you could spread your wings.
Yeah, and a lot of it has to do with people. I've said that, you know, I know a lot of people who tend to move, and they're like, oh, this place sucks, I'm leaving someplace better. And I always say, well, if you take, you can go to somewhere else and run into the same people that you run into here. It's about, you know, into the same issues that you run into, you know, anywhere else. It's just a matter of the people that you're with and who you surround yourself with. So, it's changing the narrative in yourself. And I think a lot of times, you know, we talked about this a little bit earlier, when you come out, you know, it's almost like being born again, for lack of a better term. And you have, you know, you tend to stay in kind of a rut. So if you came out when you were, you know, 16, then, you know, when you're 32, you're still 16. You know, am I saying, is that math right? That's fine, just edit that out. I think it's
fine. Yeah, you're fine.
I just, like, that might feel dumb. But yeah, I think that's right. But when you, you know, when you, no, it's not right. It's fine, I'm leaving it alone.
Yeah, it's fine.
But when you come, you know, so it's, you know, if you're still dealing with, you know, if you haven't worked on yourself and the things that you need to work on internally, it doesn't matter where you move to and what, you know, you're going to go through and deal with those same types of issues.
And you think that's harder for LGBT folks?
I do, because a lot of times, you know, we're dealing, not only are we dealing with the perception of ourselves, we're dealing with other people's perceptions of us. And in a lot of cases, you know, as soon as, you know, as soon as they find out that someone is gay, they immediately have, you know, preconceived notions of what this person is or who this person is. And sometimes that can be hard to deal with, especially if you don't fit into what they consider to be the social norms of being LGBT, mm-hmm. you know, so, or what they think of as acceptable. Mm-hmm. So if you're not like, you know, a 3 on the Kinsey scale, yeah. super masculine, right. you know, then you can run into issues. You know, I've had plenty of friends, both gay and straight, or that are like, you know, that may be a little bit more effeminate, and the way that people treat them and talk to them in their own communities and in their own neighborhoods is completely different than they would talk to, say, like my partner, who's a little bit more masculine. The way people perceive us is different. You know, him being, you know, white and me being a person of color. So those are always going to be, you know, those are things that are always going to cause, you know, some sort of sometimes internal conflicts, sometimes conflicts in your neighborhood that cause you to not feel safe.
So tell me about your experiences as an LGBT person of color. How has that influenced your journey to find home?
It is, I've always looked at myself as kind of being part of two tribes where neither of them really want you to be there, but both of them expect you to like ride for them and do, you know, everything you can for their causes.
Those two tribes being?
Being a person of color, mm-hmm. Specifically Black and LGBT.
Right.
You know, it's no secret that there is a level of segregation in the gay community. And also, there's rampant homophobia in the Black community. I think both of them are getting better to a degree. But definitely when I was, you know, younger, I remember there was, like I said, most of my friends growing up were white. I grew up in a mostly white area. So that's kind of where I gravitated towards when I got older. You know, I hung out with more white people. And I remember getting a random text message from a number I didn't know, that from someone that's like, you're the Uncle Tom. And, you know, why do you spend so much time with one of those white dudes? And you just, you know, being their coon and all of that stuff. Oh, excuse me, sorry. So those are always things that like I thought about, and they're always kind of in the back of my head. It can be tough, you know, but again, it's all about like the tribe and the people that you surround yourself with. And for me, I think that's kind of what home is. The building, the structure that you live in isn't as important as the people that you surround yourself with and who, you know, you choose to kind of go forward in life.
Do you think that's inherent to folks within the LGBT community, that it's more relational, more so than where we live?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. When you look at, you know, especially if we're looking like now, things like shows like Pose,
love that show.
Shogun is so good, isn't it? You know, but you're, you know, we are a people who, you know, there, some of us have gone through some heavy stuff. And, you know, they don't have family or people to turn to from that's blood, you know, so they go out and they create their own families and they create their own homes. They don't feel like, you know, that's kind of where the houses came from, was this idea that like, I don't have anything, but what I have are these people, and we do whatever we can to survive, and we love each other, and we fight like brothers and sisters, and we, you know, because that's all we have. And, you know, I've said before that I feel like there's, in our quest for normalcy, in the LGBT community, we've lost some of that. Mm-hmm. We've lost that sense of like, it doesn't matter where you came from. Where you came from is not, you're cool with me, we're cool, and I'll fight for you just like you fight for me. Which, again, you know, I get it in the sense of like, we want to, you know, we want the word, we want acceptance, and that's what everyone wants. And even in those little, those houses, there's that need for acceptance. But, you know, we have each other, and if we each accept each other, that's enough, you know. And I think that's kind of what's lost in, you know, that this, the new fight for equality, right. I think.
So I'm an urban planner, right?
Yes.
And so I look at space, right? And the places in which we live and exist in, right? And so urban planning has a history of being complicit in marginalizing communities. Communities of color, women, LGBT communities, immigrant communities, and all the intersectionalities that exist within them. So I'm wondering what your advice would be to the field of planning. If you could give any piece of advice to planners that may watch this or to me, how do planners create truly inclusive and equitable spaces for all people, but LGBT folks?
I think for me, the big thing is when planning, don't forget the culture of the neighborhood itself. Because those neighborhoods exist for a reason. Those people, you know, when you look at, the biggest thing I think I can think of right now is like Spanish Harlem. You know, those are neighborhoods that had that sprung up due to redlining and other, like, the ills of urban planning,
right,
for lack of a better term. But they have a distinct flavor and a distinct scene. And sometimes when, you know, we look at these neighborhoods and we're like, oh, well, we can move in and we can create these new centers and these new spaces and kind of revitalize these neighborhoods. But in doing that, you also can whitewash, for lack of a better term, the neighborhood, you know, and understand that those neighborhoods have a history, and you have to, you know, honor those, that history, just as much as you can revitalize the neighborhood. Yeah.
It's what I love about oral history so much, is because you're really getting to the root of that, right? You're learning the lived experiences of people who live in those places.
Right.
And it's a great tool to be able to get all that information. And so my final question.
Okay.
In one or two sentences, tell me what home means to you.
Home is family, safety, and togetherness.
Awesome. I love that. Well, thank you so much for doing this with me. I really appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
I don't have any more questions, so...
Okay, well, thank you so much for letting me do that.
Yeah.
I appreciate it. That was awesome.
Yeah.
And we're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back to talk about some more urban planning things. And we'll... Okay, so we're back, and... now, Austin, I want to now turn the tables on to you.
Yes, please ask me all of the questions.
So you are an urban planner.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about that journey and like where, what made you that be a thing that you were interested in?
Well, I've always been really interested in cities and how they work and how they don't work. Because we all know that there are many ways that cities don't work.
Right.
And for me, it was really about the people who live in those spaces as well, in those cities, and why do people live in the places that they live, and what makes a neighborhood great, or who gets to decide what makes a neighborhood is great or not. Like those dynamics have always really interested me. And I didn't really know anything about urban planning. I didn't really know that it was a thing until I got to college and I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do. I mean, I was going to be an art history major at one point.
Right?
I was going to tell you all the things about Degas and Monet and all of them. But I took one art history course and I realized that, oh, no, not for me. Love art, but don't necessarily need to be an art historian. And so I was really exploring what I wanted to do, and I was talking with a friend of mine, and he was like, you know, you talk a lot about you know, when we go out for walks or we go out, you know, for dinner, you talk a lot about how people interact in those spaces and what those spaces look like. And, you know, that really sounds like urban design, urban planning. And I was like, well, what is that? And so that's when I started to explore it. I got really, I started sitting down with advisors, sitting down with other professors, and really kind of getting to know what this crazy thing called urban planning is. And that was it. That was the history. That I was, you know, nonstop from there. So here we are now.
So a little bit of our history.
Yeah.
I've known you since you were in high school.
Yeah, I know.
You were such a little, you were a little baby.
I know.
So it's so interesting. I just have to say this, to see the Austin I remember become this like person who's standing in front of me now, like so smart. And you've always been smart and, you know, articulate, but it's just like, I'm so proud of you.
Oh, well, thank you. I really appreciate that. Well, I mean, you gotta have great mentors.
I mean, let's come on now. I was a trash.
Oh, you know what? I wouldn't have noticed.
I was a trash individual. But, you know, it's, I wanted to talk to you, like I said, I've wanted to talk to you about this for a while, because along with urban planning, and I think one of the pitfalls that we run into, I think there are two. There's the history of redlining, which, for those of you who don't know, why don't you explain what that was?
Yeah, so I mean, we get into like the history of redlining, and I'm gonna pull up my notes, because I like when we were talking about doing this, I just jotted down some of my notes, so I knew, stayed on track with like the history. Like, we got to know, remember that, you know, discrimination in housing has been around forever.
Correct.
Right, but when we talk about redlining and modern discrimination in housing, it really traces its roots back to the Great Depression era and the Federal Housing Act of 1934. It created that federal agency that provided low-interest loans to people to buy houses. It was what solidified that 30-year mortgage, and it really opened up the opportunity for people to buy houses who historically may not have been able to buy a house before.
Correct.
Because before, like, there was no such thing as this thing called a mortgage. It was very different. You paid like one large sum, you built your own house. You know, the idea of getting a mortgage from a bank to finance owning a home and paying that off over the lifetime of you living in that house, that was a new idea. But out of that, out of the Federal Housing Act, you get a lot of racial segregation.
Right.
Right. You get a policy that solidified segregation between neighborhoods and between individuals and communities. And so it really comes into place in 1935, right? And so this is where I get into my notes, and I want to make sure I'm like saying these agencies correctly. You get like the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, and they're asking the homeowners loan corporation to do an assessment of a majority of cities, major cities in America, right? And they are to create residential security maps. That was the language that they used. And essentially what that was, it was to measure the risk that banks would have to take if they were to provide a mortgage for a house in this particular area. And they were literal maps, and they color-coded them, and they would divide them between, oh, these areas are really good, and you should definitely provide mortgages to people looking to buy homes in this area because you'll definitely get a return on your investment here. These areas are older. They're still good, but they're older, so you just accept that as it is. These areas are deteriorating, but they're not necessarily a bad investment, but they could be. And then you have these other areas, which is where we get the concept of redlining, right? Where these residential security maps said, oh, these are a bad investment. These are places where you should not provide mortgages if someone is trying to move here, or if someone is trying to leave this area. Well, they're a bad investment.
Right.
Right. And, well, usually,
because I think that I think what's important in what you just said, not to cut you off.
No, absolutely.
Is not that these are a bad investment to move here, but to move away from.
Absolutely. Here. Well, because you got to think, like, in all of this time, right, we're getting into the era of urban renewal,
Mm-hmm.
And which was this massive, massive urban project, essentially, from the federal government that was, we have to clear urban spaces, which was essentially bulldoze and put a highway there. Well, we got to think about what we were bulldozing and what we were redlining. And 9 times out of 10, these were always predominantly African-American neighborhoods. And the neighborhoods that we were going through urban renewal, which was not renewal at all, it was complete destruction.
Right.
These were African-American neighborhoods. And what these red line maps did was it gave permission to banks to say, we're not going to provide a mortgage to you because, well, you're a bad investment.
not because of the color of your skin, but because of where you live.
Well, sometimes because of the color of your skin, right. too. I mean, there was a lot of just open and blatant racism and discrimination within the home finance banking world. They may not have explicitly stated it,
right.
all things, well, all the
you
time.
You knew what it was.
But you knew what it was. And it, what it did, and it really, we know that housing is a form, is one of the greatest forms of ways to create wealth.
Yes.
For yourself. And we know that white people have historically had greater access to housing and still have greater access to be able to buy a home than African Americans do. And well, when you have generations and generations of African American communities who are unable to access the financial mortgage to be able to buy a home, to be able to invest, to be able to build equity, to build wealth, mm-hmm. then you have generational gaps in wealth
Correct.
Attainment, in you have generational poverty. And you have this gross disparity between the amount of wealth that white people have versus African Americans.
Right. And I think that it's what's important about that is because that also goes to in having that wealth. So much is tied into that education.
Yeah.
You know, because your tax dollars are based on the, you know, your property values of your home. Mm-hmm. Also, if you have that wealth, you know, a lot of people, what they would do is they would mortgage their homes to pay for college.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if there's no home to mortgage, there's no way to pay for college. So they were building on, so say your grandparents had a house,
mm-hmm.
and they mortgaged that house so that your parents could go to college.
Mm-hmm.
They paid off that mortgage, your parents went to college, they then bought a house.
Right.
You know, they were able to take a step up.
Yeah.
Because they had more to give.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then here comes you who, you know, again, your parents have a house now. They can mortgage that house to make sure that you go to college.
Right.
And, but, you know, when you're talking in terms of, like, these redlined areas where they were considered bad investments,
mm-hmm.
they were cut off from that.
Yeah.
So they had no ability to build that wealth.
Yeah.
So essentially what they're doing is they are literally scraping by.
Yeah.
With what they, you know, with what they have.
And this is all going on while we are actively making sure that we're not investing in those things like education, healthcare, you know, opportunities, economic opportunities for African Americans, right? This is 1934, right, that
right.
this starts going on. This is 30 years before the Civil Rights Act, right? And so we're still actively in that era of Jim Crow, you know, active discrimination. In fact, you get a lot of development happening, a lot of new development happening around this time, especially post-Civil War, but also post-World War II, I mean, but pre-World War II as well, before the Depression, where developers are putting into the deeds of those houses that this house cannot be sold to someone who is a person of color, to someone who is a woman, to someone who is Jewish or not Protestant. And if you go and look at those deeds today, they're still there.
Right.
Right. These became unenforceable, you know, early on when this practice started going on, but they're still there, and you can still go see them. And it's a recognition of the legacy that housing development has in its connection to ongoing, persistent, and systemic discrimination against people of color, and it has lasting effects to today.
Right. And actually, I want to to jump ahead a little bit.
Yeah.
I do want to talk about the J.C. Nichols connection, which I think is around that same time.
Yes.
So let's start there, and then we're going to jump up a little bit. And J.C. Nichols is, for those who don't know, here in Kansas City, there is a shopping district called The Plaza.
Yes.
And I think he's famous, like he created that.
Yes. So the Country Club Plaza was built on a pig farm.
Really?
Yeah. It was before the Country Club Plaza was built, it was a pig farm. And there was nothing there. And we were miles away from downtown, which is where the hub of Kansas City was at the time. And so it's the 1920s, right? It's the golden era between World War I and World War II, right? It's a kind of sweet spot between the wars and the Great Depression starting. So there's a lot of development happening. There's a lot of energy. And so one of the big things to come out of this is the car, right? You have Henry Ford's Model T. And so driving became very accessible to people, to more middle-class individuals who could afford to get a Model T. And so J.C. Nichols had this great idea. Well, to him, it was a great idea. He was going to build this neighborhood that was going to be centered around this shopping district. The key characteristic of this shopping district, shopping districts have existed forever.
Right.
The key difference about this shopping district was that it was gotten to by car. Like the primary mode that you were to get there was by vehicle. And so some of the oldest parking garages in the city are there at the Country Club Plaza because they were built in to the structures. And it's really fascinating because when you go, you can actually tell, like, oh, this parking structure was built in an era pre, like, massive SUV.
Right.
Right?
Like, the spaces are small.
Very small, low ceilings. They were designed for the car of the 1920s, 1930s. And so around the Country Club Plaza, J.C. Nichols starts building all these new neighborhoods, all these single-family homes. And J.C. Nichols really pioneered the notion of a racially restrictive covenant, the language in those deeds that say that this house can't be sold to someone other than a white male, right. Protestant. He was a real strong pioneer in all that. And the J.C. Nichols Company also was a big proponent of blockbusting. And that's, it's all happening at the same time as redlining. But blockbusting was essentially where real estate agents would go into neighborhoods, predominantly white neighborhoods, and they would sell a house to a black family. And then that real estate agent would go to all the white families in the neighborhood and say, look at where your neighborhood's going. This is happening.
That was going to be the next thing we were talking about, which is white flight.
Yes. And so J.C. Nichols, he's developing the areas around the plaza, which is Brookside. He starts going over into the Kansas side, which is Prairie Village, you know, those neighborhoods over there. Very suburban oriented, right? And always meant for white people.
Right.
Right? And so the J.C. Nichols Company practicing blockbusting, they're selling houses to black families, and then they're going and essentially scaring, but encouraging.
You can say what it is.
Scaring white people into saying, oh my goodness, my home values are going to decrease, because that's what they told them. It was right. Like, your home values are going to decrease now because, well, look what's happening to your neighborhood. Your neighborhood is changing.
There goes the neighborhood.
And so, oh, well, by the way, how about we sell you this lovely house in this garden neighborhood, great schools, safe neighborhood, and only white families. And they would do this. I mean, they would go so far as to, they would hire actors, black actors, just to go, like, they would hire black women to push around a baby cart through a white neighborhood and just walk around the neighborhood a few times to scare white people. And so you see this massive, massive movement of white flight out of the urban core into the suburbs. And this is all going through urban renewal, mm-hmm. right? That era of urban renewal where we're building new suburbs, we're building highways, we're demolishing the urban centers, And we're allowing for white people to be able to have free range and free movement, while also at the same time restricting the options for African Americans and other communities of color.
Right.
Because, well, at the same time, African Americans are being provided less and less and less opportunity.
Right, which is where the 18th and Vine district comes in.
Right. Well, 18th and Vine was kind of a counter to it, right? It was right. It was an area for African Americans to have their own cultural center, to have an area that was theirs, that they could call their own. And it was there that, you know, you get that history of jazz and you get that history of food and culture, music, just coming out of that neighborhood. Well, and what happened to it? You know, you have in the era of urban renewal, a lot of what used to be there was torn down.
Right.
You know, that neighborhood, the 18th and Vine neighborhood was a very dense neighborhood. There was a large number of people who lived in the 18th and Vine district. And when you look at maps from that era and compare them to maps of today, that urban density there is cut in half, if not more, because you have policies from the federal level to state level to the local level pressuring the demolition, the complete demolition of neighborhoods, without ever taking into consideration the people who lived there.
Who live there. And I think that's one of the things that, for me, because it's so fun, it's to see how many, you know, like, there are so many parts here, which is a good thing. Don't get me wrong.
And so many parts that we're not even going to touch at today.
And, but it's, but like, you know, there's a park down right there by 18th and Vine. Yeah. And they're like, yeah, there used to be apartments there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, so wait, you tear down apartments to build a park? Like, cool, but also, where did those people go? And yeah. I think, you know, when you're talking in, especially in terms of like, you know, that time in between the World Wars and this urban renewal, there was a lot of, we were doing a lot of demolishing and not, you know, without providing spaces for these people to be.
Right.
Which then caused these areas, you know, the existing structures there, people, you know, people have to live somewhere.
Yeah.
So they're just cramming them all in,
mm-hmm.
you know, where they can, essentially where you can fit. And that's right. why you have, you know, even to this day, you know, you have people who, you know, they've lived with their aunts and their
yeah.
you know, multi-generational families living in, you know, one house.
Yeah.
And it's because that's just what they've always done.
Yeah. Because they've had to.
Right. And, you know, and then when you talk about white flight, like, it's, I think this area, well, not my area, but like the Bannister area
mm-hmm.
is a prime example of something yeah. like that. You know, whereas at that time there was that mall.
Yeah.
It was, you know, apparently it was like, it used to be the new hot spot.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was, as soon as the area started to get, you know, a little bit more predominantly African-American, mm-hmm. you know, the people started pulling out. And what I think is interesting about that area in particular is, it's mostly a food desert.
Right.
There's that Price Chopper there, but it's not, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and so there's not a lot there as far as retail is concerned. Mm-hmm.
Not anymore.
Right. It used to be great.
It's interesting, like, so that area, right, by Bannister Mall, the Hickman Mills area, that was, like, the model community that was lifted up by governments both here and across the state as, like, this is what we should be doing. These are the neighborhoods we should be creating. This is how we create modern cities. and what you see, especially in the era of urban renewal, even post Fair Housing Act into the 70s and 80s, you get middle-class African-Americans moving out of the urban core.
Correct.
And moving into these more affluent, middle-class, white neighborhoods, which, again, restarted that era of white flight to even further out to the fringes.
Right.
And Kansas City has been a big perpetrator of that. I mean, the Kansas City is a sprawling city. and a sprawling regional area that is very, very segregated. You can look at maps. In fact, I believe Kansas City is still one of the most segregated cities in America.
Really?
Yeah. And you, if you look at maps, there is a very dramatic line between where the white people live in the city versus where the African Americans live in the city versus where Hispanics live in the city. And you can see that along the Troost Corridor.
Yep.
That if you live on the west side of Troost, you're in a predominantly white neighborhood. If you live on the east side of Troost, you live in predominantly African-American neighborhoods. And just by living on either side of that street determines so many outcomes for your life. The average income of someone who lives on the east side of Troost drops by $50,000 compared to someone who lives on the west side of Troost. Between between $30,000 and $50,000, depending on the neighborhood that you live in.
And it's it's literally just a street.
It's literally just a street. But those streets have very real impacts, right? We always talk about how, oh, you can go to one neighborhood and it'd be this way, and you can go to, you can just literally go a block over and it could be another way. Well, those streets provide a literal barrier. We may not think about it. We may not even recognize that that's what's happening. But those streets provide a very real wall. And sometimes that's a wall that you don't ever dare cross because culturally, you know, versus with our community and how we've been raised and how we engage with people, it's just indoctrinated in us.
Well, it's so interesting because when you hear about, especially here, I mean, I dealt with it a little bit when I was living in Florida, but here, you know, the idea of like Troost.
Yeah.
You know, you don't go down by Troost and Paseo, or this is MLK now, but
yeah.
You know, you don't go down there. You know that's the dangerous. That's dangerous. That's bad. And it's for me when I lived here, when I moved here, I was like, here's the thing about Kansas City, and it's something that I think you're right about. Like, there aren't bad neighborhoods.
No,
there's
not at
bad
all.
Streets.
Yeah.
You know, and
perceived
bad streets.
Right.
But like, you know, there's no neighborhood. Like, I can't think of a neighborhood like in total where I'm like, oh, that's the hood. You know. Or that's just not, you know, there, but there are like, okay, that might be a little questionable, but like as a whole,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's relatively like, it just depends on where you are.
Yeah. Well, I think like, and this is where modern urban planning, I think, misses out a lot of times, and where like modern economic development misses out. It's like when we make decisions for a neighborhood and we go in and say, oh, we want to help them, or we want to revitalize this neighborhood. We really, modern urban planning, modern economic development forgets that there are people who already live there.
Yeah.
Who already have an existence, have a connection, have an emotional connection to where they're living and to their community. And they may not really appreciate it if you want to come in and bulldoze all their houses and build some multi-high-rise apartment or some economics, like, you know, strip mall or something, right? You may come in and say, oh, we're doing this because this is going to revitalize the neighborhood. It's going to bring new jobs in. And it's going to, you know, jumpstart all this new development. We're going to build all these new housing. But housing for who? Jobs for who?
Okay, so I say that this is a circle. It's a cycle.
It is.
So we've talked about the redlining,
right,
and how these neighborhoods were created,
mm-hmm.
and then we've talked about white flight,
mm-hmm.
which is, you know, now someone that's considered undesirable has mm-hmm. moved into a neighborhood, mm-hmm. so those neighborhoods have fallen, mm-hmm. and
you disinvest,
which drops their property values, mm-hmm. which then, you know, causes other issues,
yeah,
you know, that are education ramifications and all of that,
right.
Then we get to kind of this that now this neighborhood has become disadvantaged and poor.
Yeah.
And, you know, you see the schools are failing. You see that there's, you know, there's a lack of care from, I will say, not from the residents of the city or of the community, but from the governments mm-hmm. looking into the city.
I just wanted to say, I call, and there's this theory in like sociology and planning of the growth machine. And it's all the forces that perpetuate a lot of these things, right? It's governments, it's economic developers, realtors, it's construction companies, it's really anyone who can think about, it's bankers, financiers.
Money.
Money. It's people who have money.
Right.
And it, which generally means it's white people.
Right. So they're, so now this is no longer a good investment.
Right.
This community is no longer a good investment. So all of the money has left.
Yes.
And then we get to gentrification.
Yes, the new modern.
And what I have said is, whenever it, there are two things that I know when I know a neighborhood is about to be gentrified.
Mm-hmm.
It is a some sort of Whole Foods.
Yeah.
Whole Foods, a what is it? There's another one that, like, if you see that there's there that, that they're coming, gentrification is happening.
I always say that you know that a neighborhood is gentrifying when a coffee shop opens up.
A Starbucks,
or even like a small independent coffee shop.
Mm-hmm.
You know that a neighborhood is gentrifying when there's a coffee shop that opens up.
And then the next thing is when you start seeing pride flags.
Yep.
Because it always seems that when it, when the gays move into a neighborhood, gentrification is not far behind.
Right.
And it's not. And I don't say it's the fault of gays, because we just move wherever.
Well, it's because you got to think, LGBT folks are often marginalized from housing
as well
themselves.
Yeah.
So, especially LGBT folks of color,
right?
You add in that intersectionality, and so queer people go to places where they can afford to go, because against all the like broader thinking in the world, like. That says that gay people have more money than straight people.
We don't.
It is not. That is not true, right? The myth of the
dinks.
Yeah.
Dual income, no kids.
Exactly. You know, and they're always like white men. You know, yeah, no kids. They've got their two corgis or something. And,
yeah.
And they've got all this money, and they have a beach house in Malibu.
I haven't met none of them yet.
I haven't met any single person like that.
No.
So queer people, LGBT folks, go to where they can afford to go. But it is oftentimes a precursor to gentrification.
And so, you know, then they move in, and then once, you know, once they move in, now it's, now all of a sudden this becomes the hip hop hot new spot.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're changing the name of the neighborhood.
Yeah.
You know, where it was, you know, at first it was, you know, it was South Bronx, for example. Now it's Sobra.
Yeah.
Like it's something, it's, you've shortened the name or you've changed the name to kind of get rid of that.
Yeah.
The what the sting or the stigma of what the old neighborhood
was. When you
was.
Think about like the River Market or the Crossroads Arts District, right? It was not the Crossroads Arts District, right? That was
right.
That was their marketing ploy. That's how they were able to sell this to people, to bring people in. The River Market was the River Key back in the day, and it was, and both those places were places where like gun battles happened.
Right.
Right. And you get all this, you get people coming in, artists, LGBT folks, you know, poor folks coming in. They're living in these lofts, these old warehouses, because it's affordable, it's cheap, and they're doing all the things that these communities do. They survive, they create their own culture, their own community. They create art, they create this new. An interesting thing.
Right.
And what happens? Well, you get people who say, oh, I can monopolize on that.
I want to live there now.
I can capitalize on that. I can make money off of that.
Right.
And so you get the growth machine, these developers, these economic interests coming in and saying, buying up all these properties because, well, they're cheap. You can do that. Flipping them, selling, you know, and at first it was like, we're going to flip these and sell them as condos.
Right.
People can buy in. Well, now it's, We're gonna take these, we're gonna renovate them, and we're gonna turn them into apartments, and we're gonna slap on, you know, the title of luxury, and it's gonna say this is your new urban life.
Right, new. It's rustic, or
it's historic.
It's historic, and it's so interesting because what they do is, you know, one of the things they do is they will go in, and these people that have been living in this neighborhood for, you know, generations. You know, they now no longer can afford the taxes of living in this place that they've lived in. So then, you know, someone comes in and they're like, oh, well, we'll offer you $150,000 for your house. And it's which sounds on paper like, oh, that's, you know, that's amazing. I can change my life. Yeah. But then they're going in and they're spending maybe $20,000 in renovations and then selling it for $300,000.
Yeah, or $400,000 or $500,000. Yeah.
And, you know, it's, you know, and then in doing that, those then people, new people then move into the neighborhood, and rather than letting the neighborhood be what it is,
yeah,
which I think is my, I would not have an issue with people moving into a neighborhood that did not look like the neighborhood,
yeah,
if the expectation wasn't that the neighborhood changed
for them, yeah,
because that's what the expectation is now.
Absolutely,
yeah,
and you know, I don't think anyone would ever tell you, you know. There is a long history of disinvestment in neighborhoods, and that has led to, you know, a loss in housing options, a loss in a reduction in sustainable infrastructure, right? There are a countless number of neighborhoods that don't even have access to safe sidewalks to walk on.
Right.
Right. And no one, and a lot of people will say, well, you know, that's just what gentrification is. Gentrification is you put in new sidewalks and you build new housing, and that's all. That's what it is, and people should accept that because that's good. That's good for everyone. Oh, well, yes, nice sidewalks, safe sidewalks for people to walk on are good, but that should be an inherent quality in all neighborhoods.
Correct.
And that shouldn't be what forces people out or jumpstarts a system, a process that ultimately ends in someone having to leave their community, leave their home, because they can no longer afford to live in it because of the rapid investment that's going on in their neighborhood and the rapid change that leads to displacement.
Well, and I think that part of it is, to me, like that last piece that we talked about is the thing that's important. When moving into a neighborhood, I hate to say Becky, but it's best, like,
yeah,
that's what it is.
It's Becky.
You know, when Becky moves into the neighborhood,
Becky with the good hair,
Becky expects, you know, for her neighborhood to be like her old neighborhood that she moved out of.
Right.
You know, and so, you know, when their people are playing Spanish music, you know, loud at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, oh, that disturbs her.
Right. And that's when you call, that's when you get a lot of people calling the police,
mm-hmm,
which only furthers the interaction that between police and communities of color. And there's that whole history of over-policing, you know, communities of color, people of color, you know, the bodies of people of color.
Right.
There's a whole, like, bunch of literature out there on just how we design spaces to police people's bodies, right? We see, like, the handlebars on benches that are in the middle of the bench.
Right.
Rather on the ends.
Rather on the end, so that we can keep homeless people
from laying down. Uh-huh. Those are features that you see in predominantly communities of color, right? Because it's a way of policing, you know, people of color's bodies.
I've never thought of that.
Well, see, now I've said it, and you're gonna
see
it
every
everywhere.
Time. It's gonna piss me off.
You're gonna see it everywhere. It's gonna make you so angry, and you're gonna have to, like, you'll write about it in on Facebook or Twitter or wherever your social media is, and then what I like to call white Twitter will be mad at you.
Oh, well,
because they're just like, well, this is good things. These should be happening.
And the thing is here's my thing. Like, is there a way? And I don't want to take up too much more of your time. But is there a way, and I'm hoping that you can give me good news on this, to not gentrify a neighborhood, revitalize a neighborhood, while still keeping the same spirit and flavor of that neighborhood?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is where it really takes, there's a lot of stuff that has to happen. I will fully admit that. And there's a lot that has to happen within, like, the planning community, the planning field, just simply diversifying the planning field so it's not just straight white men going into neighborhoods of color and saying, this is how you do this.
Right.
You know, that doesn't work. I am very grateful in the program that I'm in right now. There's a lot of conversations about the topic of storytelling and how storytelling can influence and educate people and also spur positive change that is empowering, right? Because, you know, we talk a lot about equality, right? What does equality mean? And I don't know if you've seen that, like, that picture of the baseball field and,
yes,
you know,
equity, equality, and, yeah.
Yeah, and so, you know, equality is like everyone's on the same level, but there's still folks who can't see over the fence.
Right.
Right. And then, well, equity, you've got people who everyone can see over the fence, even though there may be someone needs to stand on higher boxes. It's just making sure that everyone has access and it's included. But I like to go that extra step, and I don't necessarily know if we're there quite yet, but I think it's important that we have these conversations where we acknowledge it. But the concept of liberation, right? You take down the fence altogether. And that really gets into systems changes, right? Structurally changing the way that these systems work, dismantling the growth machine, and making sure that it's people, right, the communities themselves, that have power, that can, that have agency, that have the ability to make decisions for themselves. It's not people who have money. It's not white people coming in and telling communities of color what to do. It's not politicians dictating things from, you know, their spots in City Hall or the state legislature. It's not even academics sitting in their white towers and writing research papers and saying, this is how you fix neighborhoods. This is how you do these things, right? Because we've been doing that for the last 60, 70 years in modern planning, and it hasn't done anything. It hasn't worked. It's only perpetuated the ongoing accumulation of wealth for people at the top. And so we really do need to have folks who understand that and are willing to work within the inside, I believe, to really challenge those, but also people on the outside, those activists, those people in the community, those folks on the ground who can also challenge them from the outside and say, no, this is not how this is supposed to work. This is what we need to do instead. And I'm a firm believer it's got to be people-driven, community-led, and it has to really center around those stories and the emotional components that come with them and the connections that we have not only with the place we inhabit, but also the connection we have with each other. That's really difficult to do because a lot of this stuff is so analytical and we try to remove the emotion from it, but like we really can't.
Right.
Because planning and where we live in our neighborhoods and how we interact with them, it's inherently emotional. It's inherently tied to how we feel.
I mean, it has to be. It's where you live.
It's where you live, yeah. And so much stuff happens there, right? It's not necessarily... Like, when I talk to people in neighborhoods, it's... People spend less time talking about what's wrong with their neighborhood. Because, I mean, that's easy. People can go down that list and it's like, right. Okay, well, I wish this were different. I wish this were different. People talk about their memories, the things that they've done. They talk about, oh, I took my kid here once and we played this game, or oh, my family had a reunion in this park, and oh, I really wish that, you know, the city would cut the grass more often because I would love to really be able to take my family back there to do another reunion. Right, it's the memories, and that really matter, I think. And
well, and I think part of that is when you see people you know, fight hard to save things in their community.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of that is because there are memories there.
Yeah.
And it's so tied, and it's tied intrinsically. Your neighborhood is tied intrinsically into who you are.
Yeah.
And, you know, where you grow up and who you are, what that's so much of like, all of that emotional connection is there. And so for... And, you know, and I think that's a lot of why there's a lot of pushback when you talk about gentrification, because it's literally changing the DNA of the neighborhoods
yeah.
that these people are in.
Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of folks who are on the pro-gentrification side, they fail to see that. They fail to see the emotional component of it, that what they see is, oh, this is a nice area now. But what we define as nice is so subjective.
Right.
And the folks who have the most money, the folks who have... you know, the power, they're the ones who get to decide and dictate what is nice.
Right. And, you know, and a lot of it is because, and a part of it, I would say, is because when you're dealing with neighborhoods that are disadvantaged, because they don't have a lot, their neighborhoods are stronger.
Yeah.
Their ties to their community are stronger.
Yeah.
So for those people who are like, oh, it's nice, you know, they've, if you've always lived in a nice neighborhood that was, you know, where nothing ever went wrong and no one ever, you know, you didn't know your neighbors because you didn't have to.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have those same emotional ties.
Yeah.
So, of course, you don't see, oh, well, you're like, well, this neighborhood's trash.
Yeah.
And, you know, all we're doing is making it better.
Well, one of my favorite historical figures in like the realm of urban planning and urban theory is Jane Jacobs. And she was an activist. She was not like a certified planner. She had really no, she didn't finish college or anything like that. She was a housewife who lived in Greenwich Village, in New York City. And she wrote this really compelling book called The Death and Life of Great American Cities, where she detailed how, what makes a great neighborhood and what makes a great city. And what it was is that, yeah, there may be a mix of different housings that might be of a different age and quality, but at the end of the day, there are people.
Right.
There are people here, and they're on the streets, and they're engaging and connecting with each other at all times of the day and night. And that is what makes a strong community. That's right. What makes a healthy community. That's what makes a neighborhood so great and attractive. And I think a lot of people fail to realize that that exists in a lot of these neighborhoods that people want to gentrify. And we risk losing that when we force people out to the fringes.
Right.
And, you know, it's my job as an urban planner to recognize that and to really fight back against that, to push back against the growth machine and say, no, we really have a responsibility to empower communities, all neighborhoods and all individuals. And we can't do the things that we've been doing historically, enforcing people out. That just, it's not right.
Austin, I love you.
Oh, I love you too.
That was so great.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, so where can the people find you if they want to talk to you?
Yeah, so I'm on Twitter. Twitter's a great place to get a hold of me. It's Austin Strassel, AustinStrassle. And that's a great place to communicate with me. I love talking about urban theory and planning and cities and how we can all work together to make them accessible and equitable for all of us. And yeah, it's a great place to get a hold of me.
Well, I definitely want to have you back for some roundtable discussions on things.
I would love that.
That's amazing. Before we go, I have to do one thing. I have to send a very special birthday shout out to our co-host, Linda Blue. Happy birthday, sweetheart. I gave you exactly what you wanted for your birthday, which is to be left alone. We have a new platform that we're on. Oh, we're on Spotify now. So there's that. You can find us on Google Play. You can find us on Apple Podcasts. Anchor is our new home for our podcast. So don't forget to check them out. Let's see. You can give to our Patreon. It's KC_caffeine. Find us on Facebook at KC Caffeine. Find us on Twitter at KC Caffeine. KC_caffeine. Find us on Instagram at KC_caffeine. You can email us at KCCaffeine@gmail.com. I don't think I've forgotten anything. That's it for us tonight. You guys enjoy your night and stay woke, folks.